Hello. Today we're talking about securing AI. It's a podcast series with Verizon, produced by innovationoz.com. Today we have with us Rob Lebusk, who is the Regional Vice President Asia Pacific for Verizon, and Dr. Hewan Curtis, the Digital Resilience Network. Dr. Curtis has previously been with both ASPE and the Tech Policy Design Center, and very well suited to join this podcast discussion today. We're talking about applications versus implications. Generative AI in mainstream Australian business, there is a lot to talk about. Thank you both for joining us today.
Great to be here. Great to be here, Corey.
I might start, Rob. You have a really good view of the way that large organisations, both in Australia and regionally, are grappling with AI. It's been a very hot topic and it's on the tip of everybody's tongue. But what is actually happening? Where are you seeing the adoption? Where are you seeing the challenges? What are we talking about with larger organisations and government and generative AI at the moment?
You're right, Corey, in that it is certainly on the tip of everyone's tongue. But what I would say from an enterprise perspective is that the general observation would be that generative AI is broad-based, but with very narrow impact at the moment for most organisations. And what I mean by that is broad-based. There's clearly a lot of interest. There's a lot of focus and energy on understanding the platforms, the technology, how it can transform business processes or customer relationships. But the impact at the moment, certainly economically, is fairly narrow. So what we're broadly seeing in adoption currently is lots of experimentation, but fairly minimal live fire deployment of applications. So it might be in a thin wedge of a particular customer service application, or it might be in DevOps application. So a very particular specific use case within the enterprise. There is a general feeling and sense that this technology will definitely be a multiplier, particularly for knowledge worker productivity.
It's a good place to bring you in, Hewan, talking about cyber resilience. What's the role cyber resilience can play in the safe adoption of AI technologies?
Thanks, Corey. So AI governance, like cyber resilience, is really about managing uncertainty in a rapidly evolving technological landscape, both in AI and cyber security. Both domains really grapple with the challenge of governing complex systems where we don't know the full spectrum of risk. And also, I think the other component is that there's a huge number of stakeholders that are relevant to the conversation that need to be part of a conversation. And those stakeholders have varied resources and also relative levels of power and have a stake in what that future looks like. In the work that I've just completed, which was about telecommunications resilience, which is feeding into Australia's national approach to resilience in this very important critical infrastructure sector, I drew on the UN principles of critical infrastructure resilience. And through really extensive stakeholder consultation, we were able to bring about a shared vision of what the future of this sector looked like, where there's incredible differences in what the competitive landscape is, and then also what communities need compared to telecommunications providers. What we developed then, and you'll see this in other kind of governance approaches to AI, principles that help to guide behavior and capability development in this type of sector. And so they were things like shared responsibility, social, economic, and environmental responsibility, but also how that filters down to an organizational level about a commitment to continuous learning and embedding lessons from innovation and adaptation to change. I think this larger story of kind of safe adoption is fundamentally about how we learn from mistakes and how that feeds into innovation strategies. And at the sector level where I've been looking at, you know, we see Australia loves the Royal Commission as a way of learning, but that's not necessarily a particularly efficient way of driving innovation in response to change. With cyber resilience, there is a sense of creating a shared vision and a sense of purpose at the organizational level and using that to drive change through people, processes, and technology. And I think in a broader sense, that sense of vision about this technology is kind of what's needed given the broader context of fracturing of the techno-utopianism that has characterized some of these technologies. I think it's kind of unfortunate in many respects that the cultural narrative around AI started off with, oh, it is going to destroy all jobs, when in fact it can be used to supplement and to change the task structure of jobs. And so incorporating that sense of like vision, empowering your staff in response to change, I think, is a really critical component of it. So that's where I think that cyber resilience piece comes in as an important way of driving change and innovation in the space.
Rob, Hewlin's mentioned stakeholders and this social change and engagement and continuous learning. You see that obviously on the other side where organizations are looking at, well, who are their stakeholders? Might be regulators, it could be customers and partners. Any reflection on some of Hewlin's comments from where you see the world?
Yeah, I'll address it in two parts, Corey. The first is from an enterprise perspective. So certainly in Verizon, when we looked at how we were going to use Gen AI platforms in our own environment, the fundamental approach that we used was that if we're going to unlock enterprise-wide value, we need an enterprise-wide approach to how we engage with the technology. So one of the first things that we did was we set up a cross-functional COE of between 15 and 20 people within the organization from all functions, corporate functions like finance, HR, operations, all the way through to product management, product engineering, and all of those more forward-facing functions. And we brought them together so that they could really provide a helicopter view of the technology and how it was going to be applied to certain use cases and certain areas of the business. The second thing we did was we built a common platform of tools and workflows so that if the product marketing organization wanted to use the tool set, they had a range of different use cases, applications, and templates they could draw down on to help them to accelerate their testing and their experimentation with the tools. So we had a COE that gave us an enterprise-wide view, and then we enabled specific functional areas to accelerate their efforts using common tools and platforms. So from an enterprise perspective, understanding that as with any real technology, ultimately, the way that I describe it is that it doesn't matter what the underlying technology is. We could be talking about software-defined networking or convergent private networks, or in this case, we're talking about generative AI. Ultimately, in any organization, from an IT perspective, you want dynamic users to have connection with dynamic applications. And so the better that you can enable that and the more frictionless way that you can enable that interaction, the better. The only potential increase in focus for generative AI is that it's an emerging area. And so the risk framework, the governance framework, and certainly the policy settings perhaps aren't as well formed as they are in other areas. The other one that I'd just reflect on is this sort of concept of more broadly cyber resilience and where does this puzzle piece of Gen AI fit into that overall discussion as Hewlin reflected on? I mean, from a security operational perspective, you've got the usual enterprise risks. You're concerned about the leakage of PII, DLP generally. You're looking at intellectual property leakage into aggregated LLMs and other things that you need to care for and control. And so I can imagine a world soon where there's a discussion or an application around broadly what you'd call an LLM firewall. So in today's world, companies use firewalls and proxies to manage traffic and information that flows back and forth to the broader internet, but a similar concept that controls and manages information and traffic that flows from an organization out to an LLM and back again. And within that, you can build policies, you can create settings, you can guard for the protective regimes that you might sit under, whether it's HIPAA compliance in the healthcare industry or others. And so therefore, it gives you the way to manage from a technology perspective the settings for information as it flows in and out of the organization. This is important today. It'll be even more so tomorrow when things like agentic AI platforms become the norm. So neural language models, decision-making models that can take autonomous decision-making and action paths for an organization. Having those guardrails and those policy settings will be even more important then, because all of a sudden, you don't just have the stakeholders in your organization. As Hewlin reflected, you could have stakeholders that are customers or the customers of your customers or other parties that interact with the services that you provide to the community or to the population or the public generally that will have a stake in making sure that those systems are robust and secure.
Can I just add something to what Rob said? Because I think it's about reflecting on why AI projects fail when you don't see that interplay between different components of an organization. I read a report from RAND recently that said if there's a disjuncture between the technologists who are obviously coming up with technical solutions to this and then the business experts, there can be a mismatch between expectations and the ability to achieve objectives. And that often is the difference between success and failure in these projects. So I think that you really see a key role of communication and inter-organizational communication, but then also awareness about where your organization is positioned within a marketplace as a really key driver of whether or not that works or not.
Robert, I was really interested in what you're talking about, like say firewall or actual guardrails, because I think one of the things I hear, either technical people or C-levels in large organizations, is often the people that have their hands on the most sensitive data don't realize how much you do not want it out in the wild. And putting those practical kind of guardrails around that, and as a technology company, how you're viewed to look at pragmatic, practical steps. You and in your work, in terms of kind of policy, is it hard to get it from the theoretical into the actual applied? Is that you come at it from a different perspective? As a technology company, obviously Verizon looks at things in a different way. How are you seeing other organizations looking at this stuff and looking at the practical guardrails, if you like?
So are you talking about how policy people are navigating the policy frameworks that might guide their behavior?
Yeah, because policy can be quite kind of nebulous. And I think what Rob was talking about is quite kind of practical, because as an organization, you're looking at the kind of flow of securing and transferring information around a business. It's a different, I guess, genesis, if you like.
I think the short answer is that there's actually no neat answer to that question. And I think in the larger context, we've seen this cottage industry of people trying to work out what the best approach is, or the most appropriate approach is, to basically ensure that there is both a drive for innovation, but also guardrails or safeguards around what is happening. I think one thing that I've been looking at is that role of leadership, I suppose, in engaging and understanding precisely what the context is and what the organization's responsibility is. I came across in the New South Wales report on their innovation ecosystem and what they've done in New South Wales, a line from Louise McGrath from the Australian Industry Group, where she said that fundamental to maximizing take-up of AI will be lifting the capability of leaders and managers to develop and execute new business strategies that ensure Australian businesses are equal to, if not exceeding, their international peers. And so in that sense, it's not just about the C-suite, but it is also about integrating expertise throughout an entire organization, matched to, I think, the question about ethical guardrails and whether that is an ethics framework or a risk-based approach, they're going to be appropriate in different contexts. But the question, I think, is ultimately about leadership and empowering people to experiment and innovate across the board. And that is really a responsibility of leaders.
Just to pick up on that, Corey, in Verizon, we're very aware of this idea of enabling leaders and managers with the tool set and knowledge to make sure that they can both manage the platforms and the application appropriately, but also have an eye on the value equation for it as well. So under our Gen AI program in Verizon, we launched financial operations training for all individuals that were eligible to use the Gen AI stack internally. And what that training did was help them at a practical level understand cost implications of different types of LLMs. So whether the cost of a base model or a highly tuned model, the cost of hosting or on-prem solutions, and helping them really understand what those cost dimensions were. Because that's a really key input into how you then build a business case to describe value for the enterprise, of course. The other aspect there is then making sure that they had a very clear line of sight into the reporting and business case progress internally, all the way up to an executive review, so that we could understand some of these areas that Hewan mentioned around ethical use, you know, protection of sensitive data information and others, and then making sure that we can tick boxes against certain compliance regimes that we need to meet within how we operate. Certainly, you know, I love the phrase, keep a human in the loop, when you talk about artificial intelligence generally, but you do well to recognize as well that humans can be our largest fallibility. We're talking about really, really complex technology, And if we look at just recent history in Australia, and we look at the example of anti-money laundering, so AML policies and settings within the financial services sector, a very complex technology stack created situations where organizations fell foul of those AML requirements. It's not through any ill will or malicious activity. It was the complexity of the technology and tuning that to meet the requirements set by policy and regulation. And so I think that as organizations in Australia have certainly reflected on those examples and are treading more thoughtfully and more deliberately as they go into AI application and use.
As a final question for both of you, and it goes to, I think, comments you both made, is around the idea of leadership and being able to understand and challenge things like bias or misinformation and how we make sure that there's sort of active engagement and questioning things before you realise that sometimes there's not the interrogation to make sure that we're not, you know, tolerating bias or misinformation in our organisations. Do you have sort of thoughts on how that's being managed, or are there opportunities to think more critically about it?
So in terms of the project that I've just completed about telecommunications resilience, one thing that was really striking about bringing these different stakeholders together was that there was a kind of lack of an ability to think through the consequences of total failure. And there were many examples that were thrown up to us, not just in telecommunications, but also in other sectors. So people pointed to the South Australian power outage. The Optus outage obviously recently comes to mind, but also DP World, where I saw a great presentation from DP World about their response to that outage. But what was really revealing is that they said, oh, we were planning to undertake a scenario of what happens when something goes wrong. And I think this is kind of a symptom maybe of a regulatory structure where we don't allow conversations between different entities about common problems. And so it feeds a cycle of complacency, perhaps, between different entities, and then a failure to kind of think through what might be the consequence of total failure. And so misinformation and data bias is one component of failure. But I think in that context, what we need to keep falling back to is, if there is these issues about misinformation data or a failure of security, actually, is it an exposure of a disconnect between the application that might be being developed and purpose of what it reveals? So the economic or social or environmental consequences of some of these activities. So I think that's, in a nutshell, what we need to get better at is thinking through the consequences of these AI applications and what they might mean in a broader sense.
Kieran's right, Corey. It's a really narrow path that we need to walk to success here in the Australian context. On one side is more intelligent and more robust frameworks around risk, as Ewan has just reflected on. At a base level, we're adding a new vector of technology to the technology universe or the technology enterprise. It's another expansion of the attack surface. And with history as a guide, we've learned that bad actors are very imaginative when it comes to identifying areas of vulnerability and opportunity, certainly in new technologies that we bring to adoption at large scale. So it's managing risk, compliance, it's managing very inventive ways that bad actors can seek to use that technology, either for access for other malicious activities or for misinformation, disinformation, and other things that might seek to disrupt systems of critical national importance or infrastructure. But the other side of that path is there is clear productivity benefit. And if we think about the economic inputs, not just in the short term, not just in the next 12 months, but in the next 5, 10, 15 years for Australia to remain economically competitive in this region and globally, we need really strong productivity inputs. And we're not going to get there with people necessarily, with the vector of our population growth. I'm not an economist, but at a high level, but we can definitely get there with the smart adoption and application of new technologies that allow us to do more with less or more with the same knowledge workers. That's the great unlock that we need to focus on. And we need to focus on it collectively from a government perspective all the way down to individual organisations and how they can apply the technology to extract value. So I'm broadly really positive about the future, but it is a narrow path that we need to navigate in the short term.
I think that's a brilliant way to leave today's discussion, Rob. Lots of opportunity, lots of great things that can be achieved, but it is a narrow path. And thanks to both of you for teasing out some of the challenges, but the opportunities. Dr. Ewan Curtis, Rob Lebusque, thank you both of you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
We hope you enjoyed this special Verizon podcast. For more, keep tuning in to Innovation Oz podcast or go to verizon.com.